Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, two very different views of liberalism. Joe Klein of Time Magazine talks about what some people think is wrong with liberalism.
He believes that liberal cliches are worse than conservative cliches because they're statist. They are ways to simplify the statist project and pull the wool over people's eyes.
And author Jeff Shessel tells us what might be right about liberalism.
It was about equal opportunity. And it was about giving everyone at every income level, everyone of every background, the opportunity to participate in the economic life and, of course, political life of the country.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. So the war for and against liberalism continues. There's a new book. It's called The Tyranny of Clichés, How Liberals Cheat in the War of Ideas. It's by Jonah Goldberg and reviewed for us by the great Joe Klein, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Joe.
Good to be here, Sam.
All right, clichés. Well, we all use them. Goldberg's making a particular case that liberals rely on them more. They use it to win debates or to cheat in debates? What's he saying?
Well, he grudgingly acknowledges that conservatives use them too. But since he believes, and this is an outcropping of his last book, Liberal Fascism, in which he argued rather hilariously, I think, that the heart of liberalism, the tradition of liberalism, was also the same statist tradition as fascism.
And so you could draw a direct line from Woodrow Wilson to Hitler to Hillary Clinton. And
Woodrow Wilson is especially a bad guy in this kind of way of looking at things, because he really began a lot of things like the income tax and so on. But he believes that liberal cliches are worse than conservative cliches because they're statist. They are ways to simplify the statist project and pull the wool over people's eyes.
Now, Joe, just so our listeners get it, this idea that liberalism is really statism is one that conservatives have been making for a very long time. You go back to the origins of National Review in the mid-50s. They were saying this. Then it kind of fell away, and now it's back again. How did this happen?
It's back again at the weirdest time, because liberals stopped being statists a long time ago. There was a time when liberals were in favor of things like socialized medicine and so forth. Now most of Barack Obama's ideas originated in the Republican Party. Things like the individual mandate, universal health care version, cap and trade. These are all Republican ideas. The liberals nowadays would rather bail out auto companies than own auto companies. Nobody believes in socialism, in pure socialism anymore.
So what are some of the particular cliches Goldberg writes about? One of them, for instance, that you discuss is the slippery slope. What's his argument?
Well, that's a pretty good indication of what this book is all about, because he uses all these examples of liberals using slippery slope as a rhetorical mechanism. The abortion rights people believe that if you cut back on any procedure, then you're headed down the slippery slope toward abandoning abortion. But the same thing is true of the NRA, of the gun people, that if you put any sort of controls on guns, you're headed toward, down a slippery slope where guns will be banned. And in the end of the chapter, Goldberg says, well, actually, conservatives do this too, so never mind. And never mind seems to be the bottom line on many of the things that he comes up with. They are irrelevant in the end, because the cliches he's talking about don't relate to actual policy problems or problems of political philosophy that we're really dealing with in this country right now. He exists in some kind of theoretical universe that is a figment of his own imagination.
Right. There's almost nothing about actual policy or issues of governance. It's all about the debate, about the dialogue. Now, what does Goldberg have to say about ideology? That's one of his big arguments too, right?
Right. Well, the thing that as a flaming moderate, the thing that I find most obnoxious about this is the relentless defense of ideology and of ideologues as just people who have a worldview. He argues that moderation, that centrism, that pragmatism is also an ideology, since it's just a worldview. And then he argues against this ideology by saying that if Sunnis believe that you should kill all the Jews and Sufis believe that you shouldn't kill any Jews, the moderate position is that we should kill half the Jews. And I haven't heard arguments like that since elementary school recess. This is, you know, sandbox casuistry.
Now, when he contrasts conservatives and liberals, which every now and again he does, he'll say, well, it's true, conservatives may engage in some of the same style of debate. His argument is that conservatives are more honest about their ideology because at least they come out and admit it. What do you think of that point?
That's also pulling the wool over our eyes, because what he actually says is that all of these conservative arguments are about a single simple thing, freedom. Conservatives are for freedom. Liberals are for the state. That is nonsense. It's just not true.
Does he ever really define freedom in this
book? No, he has nothing to say about policy. I mean, in the end, real debates, real political debates in our society aren't about the number of Jews you're going to kill. You know, it isn't the Sunni Sufi debate. It's how much the cost of living increase for Social Security should be each year. And there you have conservatives who say, well, we shouldn't increase it. And liberals should say that we shouldn't increase it in a certain way. And a compromise is reached. The notion of compromise in Goldberg and also in this new right that you've written about, Sam, the notion of compromise has been, you know, has been degraded and denounced.
You know, another thing that's interesting about it, Joe, is to read a book like The Tyranny of Clichés, to read a writer like Jonah Goldberg and some others, you would think liberals continue to dominate American politics. And we look back over the last 30 years and it's, if anything, it's the Republican Party and conservative arguments, as you say, Barack Obama has borrowed many of them, that seem to be dictating the debate. Why this opposite belief coming from the right? What are they seeing? Who is this book really written for or at or about?
The right in this country, especially with the growth of right-oriented media like Fox News or the Drudge Report, it's become a hermetically sealed feedback loop. When you write a book with the title Liberal Fascism, or, you know, a book, The Tyranny of Clichés of How Liberals Cheat in the War of Ideas, you're thinking about a certain market. And there is a very pronounced, decided niche market for conservative materials now. There's a smaller one for liberals, but you have all of these megaphones and talk radio and, I should mention, of course, Rush Limbaugh and Fox News and some of the blogs. Conservatives can live within that space. And there are enough people in this country who believe this sort of stuff to create this market. But it is really important to point out that it is still a very decided minority of the American public. It might even be a minority of the Republican Party. But I do believe that, you know, the vast majority of Americans, and I go out on the road through the country continually talking to people, the vast majority of Americans want to have politicians who compromise. The vast majority are moderates. They may not like the idea of Obamacare, but they certainly do like the idea of Medicare. And
including the Tea Party when they're actually polled.
80%. 80%. And 90%, according to polling we've done at Time Magazine, 90% of the American people would rather have politicians who compromise than politicians who stand by their principles.
I remember you had a big cover story in Time Magazine, oh, maybe a couple of summers ago, where you traveled across the country and found, even in the direst times among quite conservative people, if you asked them, would you rather have a big jobs program that puts people back to work or trim federal spending in the deficit, they favored the jobs program.
That's right. You know, the interesting thing about all of this business about ideology is when you get out into the country, there aren't any ideologues. There are very few pure conservatives or pure liberals. People are a mass of contradictions. They don't want to see money going to undeserving people, but their definitions of who's undeserving, you know, are in the breeze. They change from day to day. And by the way, I'm going on another one of these road trips. I do them every year. I crowdsource them. I put out requests for proposals from Time readers and also this time on Morning Joe. And I'm going to go through the battleground states. The readers put together groups of their friends and coworkers and sit around and talk policy with me. I bring traveling companions along, and I am hereby inviting you to spend a day with me on the road.
I'd love to do it.
We could do it in Ohio the second week of June. Ohio is going to be an important state.
Well, that sounds great. And let me ask you something else, Joe, because you're talking about the campaign now. If it's true that we had so polarized a nation with views as distinct as Goldberg insists on, different worldviews or dogmas that dominate the way we think, why would so many voters be at a loss whether to choose Mitt Romney or Barack Obama? Aren't they in some way seeing them as alternatives within a middle universe somewhere?
Yeah, I don't think that we have a fearsomely divided country. It may be very divided when you get to Congress, but that was done on purpose. That was done by computer programs that developed the gerrymandered districts that we have in most congressional districts now. Districts that are guaranteed to help incumbents, districts that are guaranteed to appeal to one base or the other base. It's very much unlike what America is really like. Now, I'm not saying that 80% of the people are somewhere in the middle. There are maybe 30-40% on each side that come from Democrat or Republican traditions. But the people who decide these elections, we don't see very many 60-40 elections in this country. The people who decide these elections decide them usually in the fall. You know, they're not tuned in yet. Two guys, so far, unfortunately, it's been guys, stand up behind podiums and they have a debate. And this is the most intimate office we have in America. The president lives in your living room. And people decide who they want to have in their living room for the next 4 years. Not on the basis of specific policy positions, more on a kind of gestalt or a zeitgeist, you know, a feel that they have that this is someone who's going to do the right thing.
I trust his judgment.
Right.
You like his temperament.
In the midst of the financial crisis 4 years ago, they looked at this black guy with Hussein for his middle name, and they saw him talking about the financial crisis, and he seemed calmer and seemed to be making a lot more sense than John McCain. They voted for him. I have seen this happen in election after election, and God help me, I've now done 10 of these. There's no cure for this sort of addiction.
Joe, is there anything a liberal can learn from Jonah Goldberg's book?
Goldberg's book is an insight into the conservative, I won't say conservative, no, into the radical Republican state of mind now. True conservatism, as you know and as you've written, is, you know, far more moderate. Goldberg is playing word games. He has nothing to say about real political issues, real political policy as it's practiced in this country right now. And so Democrats can learn a little bit about the and liberals can learn a little bit about the threadbare nature of an opponent that sometimes seems overwhelming when these views are in the mouth of Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, or whomever.
Thanks so much, Joe.
My pleasure, Sam.
That was Joe Klein discussing The Tyranny of Clichés, How Liberals Cheat in the War of Ideas by conservative writer Jonah Goldberg. Next, we're joined by Jeff Schessel, writer and former speechwriter for Bill Clinton, who tells us about a new book written in defense of liberalism, The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism from Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama. It's by Eric Alterman and Kevin Mattson. Jeff Schessel, who's on the phone with us to talk about it. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you.
We'll say it's a really Eric Alterman's book because although it's a little complicated, he's the principal author of it, although Kevin Mattson is a good historian too. So what is the case that Eric Alterman is making about the fate of liberalism and where liberalism or liberals stand today?
The story he tells in beginning really with Roosevelt and carrying it forward to the present day is of liberalism losing its way, liberalism losing its fighting spirit, liberalism losing its self-confidence and its sense of clarity about itself. And the book, ironically enough, betrays some of the same faults that Alterman himself finds in liberalism. But what Alterman really tries to do here is, as I said, to begin with Roosevelt and to tell the story of liberalism, its evolution, its decline, through a lot of leading liberals. And he defines that term very broadly. So he includes not only liberal politicians, but he includes moral leaders like Martin Luther King, of course, and also leading cultural figures and intellectuals and so forth.
So what was the peak period? I mean, liberalism as we know it, or as Alterman describes, it really begins with Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. Was it on an upward swing for a number of decades then and then sort of began to taper off? What are some of the big turning points in the history of liberalism?
Well, I think that the two peaks of liberalism that Alterman and I think most historians define are of course, the New Deal and then the Kennedy-Johnson years and the Great Society, or at least the early Johnson years before everything started to spiral downward. And one of the things that I think Alterman does very effectively here is he paints a picture of liberalism very much under challenge in the 1950s. That liberalism was in many ways a house divided, even though liberal leaders were still in many ways sort of coasting off the successes of the New Deal. They got themselves caught in some of the contradictions of the 1950s when they had grand ambitions, but at the same time they adopted many of the same fears and paranoias that the conservatives had during that period of communism.
So a famous liberal thinker and writer like Arthur Schlesinger, for instance, was strongly anti-communist, and many other liberals of the period whom Alterman describes, the great scholar and critic Lionel Trilling was strongly anti-communist. Does he think that introduced a problem or contradiction on the left?
He does, and the contradiction that he sees is between the left's belief, liberals' belief in individual freedom and free expression, and civil rights and civil liberties on the one hand, and on the other hand, a fierce anti-communism that at least acceded to, even if it didn't fully endorse, the clampdown on the right on association with communists and fellow traveling and so forth, and the witch hunt of the 1950s. Liberals, anti-communist liberals, found themselves in a bit of a bind in that they didn't feel that they could fight McCarthy as vigorously as they might have liked to do, because they didn't want to be seen as aiding and abetting the forces that they themselves opposed vigorously.
So at that point then, Jeff, does conservatism begin to emerge as, you know, out of this period of eclipse it had been in during the Roosevelt and Truman years, begin to assert itself more and present a challenge to liberalism?
It does, but it's still, with the exception of the area that I described, it's still something of a subterranean challenge. I mean, these are the years of what was called consensus liberalism, when most scholars seem to believe that there really was no other tradition in American political life than liberalism. And conservatism was very difficult to take seriously during this period as an intellectual force, as a body of ideas and so forth. These, of course, as you well know, these are the years in which William F. Buckley emerges and the National Review springs up, and you start to see a little bit of life on the right, a life of ideas and ideas attached to policy ideas and so forth. But it really takes quite a while for this to cohere in a meaningful way, especially politically. It's really not until the late 60s that starts to happen. Even though liberals felt very troubled during the 1950s, they were still seemed to be, and I think rightly, as the dominant force in American life. And then, of course, this is really just the ramp up to the heyday of liberalism that we talked about just a minute ago, which is liberalism under under Kennedy and particularly under Johnson, the years of the Great Society and the great accomplishments of the early Johnson administration.
And yet it was under Lyndon Johnson that things began to turn. Vietnam was one reason, also racial strife another?
Absolutely. I mean, you had all the difficulty, all the strife and the violence in the cities. You had a kind of social and cultural collapse during those years, and so many of the gains of the Great Society, gains that really have endured, were obscured at that point in time by many of the failures, the manifest failures of the Great Society, and among them all the hope that it stirred up, and the hope that came crashing as the economy began to sour and as the Vietnam War deepened into a sort of quagmire, and as the violence and particularly the racial violence in the cities of the North and the West in California, all over the place, really, as the cities descended into violence. And so this is the beginning, the onset of the liberal collapse. But as Alterman describes, and as I think other historians have gone more deeply into, it is the shift of a kind of opportunity-focused liberalism to an entitlement-focused liberalism, really more under McGovern, more in the 1970s than in the late 1960s, that really put liberalism in a corner.
Yeah, explain the difference between those two, Jeff, between the opportunity, versus the entitlement form of liberalism.
You know, those of us who came of age during the Reagan era and subsequently, we had to fight our way through a thicket of propaganda with respect to the New Deal and the Great Society. And you would think that it had really only ever all been about the dole and dependency and all the rest of it and entitlements. And it's interesting to go back, and Alterman does a little bit with this, although, again, other historians have done more with the theme. If you go back to what Roosevelt actually said and actually did, and also Johnson as well, they were not interested in the equality of outcomes. They were not interested in guarantees of anything other than a foundation, basic security. That it was ultimately, and this was very much in the liberal tradition, it was about equal opportunity. And it was about giving everyone at every income level, everyone of every background, the opportunity to participate in the economic life and, of course, political life of the country. And, you know, it was Johnson who said, a hand up, not a hand out. That was very much Johnson's feeling. He resisted increases in food stamps and so forth, apparent hallmarks of the dependency culture, as the conservatives have called it. And it's really only in the early 1970s and under McGovern and under a number of other Democrats that you see a shift to more of an entitlement-focused liberalism, where they're actually talking about guaranteeing people minimum incomes and so forth. And this is the liberalism that was so successfully caricatured and then upended by the conservative challenge and by Ronald Reagan.
Eric Alterman and Kevin Mattson also are critical in places of what some call identity politics. That is the section or the portion of the Democratic Party and of liberals in general who want to improve the status of particular groups or subgroups in the culture.
Yes, they are very critical of that, and they're not the first on the left to be critical of the identity politics and to see that, again, as part of liberalism's undoing. And these are battles that continued well into the 1990s and probably to this day. What the focus of liberalism ought to be, is it about rights or is it about opportunities? And I think one of the difficulties with this book is that it treats these as entirely separate categories. And I think that really you can't have successful opportunity-focused liberalism without giving these previously marginalized groups much greater senses of their own rights and their own identities. And so I think ultimately these things had to go hand in hand. And if liberals overemphasized identity over a period of time, and I'm in agreement with that, I do think that there was an overemphasis, and it came at a cost to kind of economic liberalism, that there was a certain amount of inevitability to that. And I think that in the last decade or two, we have seen a shift back from that. That is not the liberalism that we associate with the Clinton years or the Obama years.
And so where do Eric Alterman and Kevin Mattson, where do they see liberalism now?
There's not a great focus on this question in this book, and I wish, actually, as someone who's very interested in that question, as many of us are, I would have liked there to be more focus on it. I think where Eric Alterman and Kevin Mattson would like us to end up is with a more economic-focused liberalism that's more focused on income inequality, that's more focused on increasing opportunity, particularly in the lower economic tiers and income tiers and so forth. And they'd like Democratic politicians and liberal leaders to be more focused on that. I think the truth is Democrats and liberals are more focused on that today. I don't think that the identity politics are playing a particularly large role in our political discussion today. It is ultimately all about jobs, as both candidates in the current presidential race have made clear repeatedly. That's what we're talking about in this country. And so I think whether Alterman agrees that Democratic politicians, whether he agrees that President Obama are doing this effectively is another question. But I do think that is the focus they're looking for, and that is the focus we have.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
Thanks, Sam.
That's Jeff Shessel, who reviews The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism from Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama, in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
Well, you had a story on the cover, the front page of the Sunday newspaper, about some very successful writers whose publishers don't think they work hard enough.
This seems to be the new metabolism of book publishing in the ebook age. You have a lot of genre fiction novelists who have started to believe that one book a year is not enough. Now, this is a very old schedule that many writers of thrillers, of mysteries, have been on for a very long time. You write one book a year, it comes out a certain month, and readers have become very accustomed to it because they think, okay, you know, Lee Child comes out in August or whatever month Lee Child comes out in, but they've come to expect it. And for a writer, it's a very predictable schedule and it's still pretty hard work. But
that's a lot of writing a book a year.
It's a lot of writing. And especially when you're writing a legal thriller that perhaps requires a lot of research and a lot of very meticulous plotting. But that system seems to have been upended now.
And who's upended it and why?
It seems like there are a lot of different pressures coming from different places. You have writers who are filled with that, you know, writerly neurosis about, you know, feeling like the book market is very uncertain right now. It's very fickle. They don't know what the future is. You have publishers who have come to believe that you really need to have your name out there a lot more than you used to if you're an author. So publishers have been kind of putting a little bit of pressure on their writers to, you know, write more, to do two books a year perhaps, or to squeeze in a short story that can be published digital only or a novella.
So you go to a famous writer, a genre writer, Lee Child, I think Lisa Scottolini is somebody else you spoke to, and they say, okay, instead of just writing that one novel, that procedural or thriller that the reader's waiting for, maybe like before the book comes out, a little taste, a morsel done as an ebook, maybe a smaller item, something like that, or a long short story just to keep the readers interested? I mean, do they have a whole system worked out that they've put them on?
It's still early days, but what seems to be developing is this system. Lee Child is a great example. He used to write one book a year, and he still does, but he's now supplementing his hardcover books with short stories that are published in digital-only format. And he did his first short story last August. It was a 40-page exploration of Jack Reacher, who's his famous character, as a teenager. This short story was released several weeks before his big hardcover novel came out in print. So it's a bit of a marketing strategy, a bit of a publicity strategy. You release the short story in order to drum up attention for the novel and perhaps get some more readers who are willing to pay 99 cents for a short story, and then you lure them in with that and convince them to pay $12.99 for the ebook or $20 for the hardcover.
Boy, it's almost starting to sound like I'm really going to date myself. The old days when the 45 record would come out before the album and you'd get a hit or two and you'd find a different audience, but maybe also bring people into the gate. It all sounds terrific. But that's a lot of work. A 40-page short story is no joke. That's a lot of writing.
It is no joke. And for a lot of these novelists who have been doing what they do very successfully for a while, writing a short story is really different. And it is exercising a different muscle. I talked to one writer who said that it took him 2 months to write a 40,000-word short story. He was working on his novel, which was coming out next year at the same time, but it really took a lot out of him. And keep in mind, writers are not really being paid for this work.
Wait, they're not getting paid extra for this?
Well, it's taken against their advance. And what happens is, their publisher will sell it for, let's say, 99 cents or $1.99, and they'll get a small cut of that, essentially. But there are no advances, which is the way that writers are usually paid by traditional publishing houses.
Are there some who just refuse to do it? I mean, they've signed contracts, presumably. These are very successful brand name authors. And your story, the people you talk to are very successful in this field. These are perennial bestsellers. So I would imagine they've signed contracts, say, a few years ago, and they can't say, oh, by the way, we may come knocking on the door and ask you to produce a 40-page short story in addition to this novel. So don't they have some leverage? Or do they really think or worry if they don't produce this other writing that they're going to miss the boat?
I think that it's very hard to pressure a writer into writing another novel every year. That, to some authors, is just a bridge too far. But it does seem to be easier for a very convincing publisher, an editor, to say, oh, why don't you just do this little short story, this little novella, we'll sell it for 99 cents.
And you will make some money from it.
And you'll make a little bit of money, and you will not only make a little bit of money from the short story, but it will increase your sales in hardcover. So that's really the pitch that it comes down to, that it's not about selling, 2,000 copies, 10,000 copies, whatever you end up selling of the short story. But it's about visibility. It's about reminding readers that you exist. And book over book, publishers say that it really does increase sales when you look at your hardcover sales and your ebook sales, which are increasingly important in genre fiction.
But Julie, this is a new phenomenon. They can already track the results. They already know. They know what's working.
Publishers say that they believe that it's working. Granted, this has really only happened for the last few years. But I talked to several publishers who said that they've seen, ever since their authors have started writing more. Lisa Scottolini is a great example of an author who used to do one book a year and now does two. And she says that her book sales have gone up book over book. So they say that it works, and if you're an author who really wants to keep doing what you love and keep writing and keep being published, it's hard to say no.
At one point, if I remember, Julie, in your story, you interviewed a Miss Scottolini, who has written for us, by the way. She's a skilled journalist before she became a thriller writer, mystery writer. She told you just how many hours she puts in as a writer. I think listeners would be interested to know this. It's a ton of work.
It's a ton of work, and Lisa was an extreme example of it. But, she said that it used to be that once a year was a really big deal, that you could saturate the market, but now the culture is a great big hungry maw and you have to feed it. And to feed it, you know, she has increased her output from one book a year to two. And she said a typical day for her is writing 2,000 words a day, 7 days a week, starting at 9 a.m. and going until Colbert.
Oh, and you wanted to be an author.
Which even makes a daily newspaper journalist shudder.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
So what's going on this week?
Well, there's just three new books on the nonfiction side of things. The number one book this week is still The Passage of Power by Robert Caro. The top new book on the nonfiction side of things is Dick Morris's treatise on foreign policy, Screwed.
Wait a minute. Dick Morris, Foreign Policy, number two bestseller in God's Great Country?
Number three bestseller.
Oh, okay. That's and what else?
At number four, Andy Cohen, the reality TV producer, executive vice president at Bravo. He's responsible for The Real Housewives and Top Chef. He has a career memoir called Most Talkative. And then the third new nonfiction book this week is down at number nine. It's a book called Service by a Navy SEALs member, Marcus Luttrell, who was rescued in Afghanistan, and he looks back on that experience.
And what about fiction?
There's a lot of turnover on the fiction list this week. In fact, half of the books are new this week, including the new book at number one. It's a new James Patterson and Maxine Petro production. It's off of Patterson's factory floor called 11th Hour. At number three, the sequel to Hilary Mantel's Booker-winning Wolf Hall. It's a book called Bring Up the Bodies, and this traces the downfall of Anne Boleyn. It continues the story of Thomas Cromwell that she started telling in Wolf Hall.
That's number three?
That's at number
three. That's mighty impressive.
Yeah, it really is. There's kind of a battle this week on the fiction list for your typical genre series books and your more serious literary books. So at number one is James Patterson. At number three is Hilary Mantel, and it represents that battle that's going on.
Who are some of the other combatants?
Well, at number four, we've got Richard Paul Evans. He, of course, is the Christian inspirational writer. He wrote The Christmas Box and a lot of other stories along conservative Christian themes. His new book is The Road to Grace, which continues a series that he's writing about a protagonist who's lost everything. His wife died. He lost the advertising agency that he started. He lost his home. And he sets off to walk across the country from Seattle to Key West. At number five this week, John Irving's new book, In One Person. So again, we have Richard Paul Evans followed by John Irving, The Continued Battle. In One Person is about a bisexual narrator, kind of follows him from prep school all the way into his late 60s.
Which is a favorite John Irving approach to storytelling.
Yes, it is. this gives him a chance to look at the AIDS era and just kind of different approaches to sexuality. You have to jump down to number nine for the next new book on the list. It's Toni Morrison's new book, Home, which is set in the 1950s. It's about a Korean War veteran, a black Korean War veteran who leaves the integrated army and comes back to his segregated country and is dealing with racism there. Then at number 11, Jeffrey Archer's new book, The Sins of the Father, makes its debut on the list this week. That is a sequel, second volume of his Clifton Chronicles, about a soldier who's assumed a new identity and is accused of murder based on the person whose identity he has assumed. At number 14, the comic writer W. Bruce Cameron has a sequel to his book, A Dog's Purpose. This one's called A Dog's Journey. It's also sort of comic inspirational. It's about a dog who is reincarnated and it's his paths through different lives. And finally, at number 16, squeezing onto the list this week, Ed Falco has a book. It is a prequel to Mario Puzo's Godfather series. It's called The Family Corleone.
So he's written a prequel. Now, Puzo himself wrote a sequel to The Godfather. Is that right? So Falco has come along now and told the earlier part of the story?
Puzo died in 1999, and I know that a sequel came out after his death, I think written by somebody else as well. They tried to continue the series that way. Falco, in fact, was approached to write that sequel in 2001, and he turned it down. He shares an agent with Puzo, and so his agent said, hey, would you be interested in doing this? Falco's a real writer. He directs the Virginia Tech MFA program. He's been collected in the Best American Short Stories. He's written a lot of experimental and kind of hypertext short fiction and novels as well. He turned down the sequel in 2001. And finally, I think he just got sick of not selling, and he approached his agent and said, look, you know, if you have any other commercial projects, I'd be interested in taking them on.
And he has his own real-life connection, or not real-life connection, but showbiz connection to the mob?
He does. In fact, his niece is Edie Falco, who played Tony Soprano's wife on The Sopranos.
Wow. So have you looked at this book?
I've flipped through it. It's set in the Prohibition era. It opens in 1933, and it kind of covers Vito Corleone's rise to power. The 30s were a time when the mafia was making the transition, organized crime was making a transition away from the Irish crime families and into the Italian crime families.
And it's also a period the films and the first classic novel don't really cover. They give you the early period and then the post-war era.
That's
so
right.
So it's really clever.
This is covering Vito's rise to power. Once he's risen to power, it's really a story, a father-son story, as so many of the Godfather stories are. And this one really concentrates on Sonny Corleone, who really wants to join the family, and his father doesn't want him to. His father wants him to go into an honest trade to become like an auto mechanic or something like that.
Well, it might have been a better choice for him.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.